Hi, everybody. Welcome to All Have Another Podcast with Lindsay Hine. I'm your host, Lindsay. Thank you so much for being here today. Today, you're listening to episode 57, and I'm talking with Sarah Canny. Sarah is the face behind the blog, Run Far Girl. She also writes for Women's Running Magazine, and she has three little kids. She also homeschools her little kids. She's the creator of the Rise Run Retreat, and Sarah shares openly about her nine-year battle with anorexia and bulimia, and we talk in depth about this in this podcast episode. Sarah is a runner. She's a morning runner, and she also has recently gotten into snowshoeing. So we talk about that a little bit, and I learned about a sport that I knew nothing about. I had a great conversation with Sarah sitting in my closet while my husband chased my kids around, while her husband took care of her two of her kids, and I think one of her kids was napping. So I knew that Sarah could very much relate to the juggling of what I do when I host this podcast. So it was fun to talk to her, another mom of three, and I know you guys are gonna love this conversation with Sarah, and I sure appreciated how open she was about some things that are really personal in her life. Before we get started talking with Sarah, I want to thank Now Foods for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. Now Foods is a leader in the natural health and foods industry, and I love them so much. I've been to their facility. I love what they're doing. You guys can get a 25% discount on your purchase from Now Foods. If you go to now-2-u.com, you can save 25% by using the promo code ANOTHER, all caps. They have protein powder, they have sports nutrition, they have vitamins and supplements and essential oils and all kinds of good stuff that will help fuel you for your running, for your everyday life, for everything. When you guys purchase something from Now Foods, you're directly supporting this podcast because they're a sponsor of the show. So just go to now-u-2.com and enter promo code ANOTHER, all caps, to save 25% off your order at Now Foods. Thanks, Now Foods, for sponsoring this episode of I'll Have Another Podcast. All right, you guys can find me on Instagram, LindsayHine626, and you can also find me on Twitter, at LindsayHine, and you can also find me on Facebook, at I'll Have Another Podcast. Okay, everybody, enjoy my conversation with Sarah. We're talking to Sarah Canny. Is that how you say your last name?
It's Canny.
Canny! Yeah. Isn't it so funny how you, like, you hear someone's name, and that's just how you say it in your head, and then when... Like, my friend Jana, her name is Jana, and for, like, a year and a half, I called her Jana until I met her.
I'm terrible at pronunciation, so I usually, you know, mess things up anyway, so, yeah.
Yeah, I've always just thought, oh, Run Far Girl, Sarah Canny. Okay, Sarah, so why don't you tell everybody just a brief little bit about yourself?
Yeah, let's see. So, like Lindsay said, I'm also known as Run Far Girl, so my blog is runfargirl.com, and I started quite a while ago. I actually started blogging when Sophia, right after Sophia was born, and Sophia's my oldest, and she is 7. Yeah, so I blog, and I stay at home with my kids. We homeschool as well, so all three of them are home with me. Let's see, I write for Women's Running Magazine as well. Yeah, just a lot of different stuff. Running, motherhood, all that.
And you guys live in Connecticut?
No, we live in New Hampshire.
New Hampshire. Oh, my gosh.
A little bit further north. Yeah.
Dude, yeah. I knew I was going to get that wrong. And people who listen to the show regularly hear me talk about my husband all the time. But I have to say, I think I mentioned that to him when I said that I was interviewing you and or, you know, having a conversation with you. And he was like, are you sure she doesn't live in New Hampshire? And I was like, oh, like, how do you know that and I don't? Like,
yeah, he was right on.
You creeper. He's just like, he pays attention to everything.
Yeah. So I was born and raised in New Hampshire.
Okay.
And pretty much lived here my whole life, except my husband Mark and I, we lived in Arizona for 4 years right after we got married. But then we moved back, so... Yeah, so we're in New Hampshire.
So did you go to Arizona for work or his work? Or
it's kind of on a whim, actually. We wanted to we had been married for about a year, and we just wanted to do something different because we were both born and raised in New Hampshire. We'd gone to school in New Hampshire. And so we just wanted to move somewhere warm because we were sick of the winter. And we were trying to decide between Florida, Georgia, and Arizona. We decided Arizona was probably a good bet. My grandparents live out there, and his wrestling coach from college lives out there as well. So I thought, well, let's go out there. Let's apply for jobs and see what happens. And we went out. So this was 2005. We both applied for jobs and got offers the weekend that we went out there to visit, which is, we thought, well, I guess we should move then. So, so we drove. We actually left. We were in Maine on vacation at my mother-in-law's house, beach house, and we left Maine and we drove all the way to Arizona. So like from corner to corner.
Oh my gosh.
United States, yeah. And we were out there for about 4 years, and and then we moved back. So
why'd you come back?
Well, it was basically the crash of 2008, like when the economy crashed. We had bought a house and like went upside down on the house and tried to rent it. So we, and also both of our jobs just sort of bottomed out. Mark was, he was working as a manager for Lifetime Fitness. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys have Lifetime, and we don't have Lifetime in the Northeast, but it's down in Arizona. So he was a personal trainer and managing Lifetime, and yeah, he just lost a ton of clients because everybody stopped paying. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. when the economy bottoms out, you cut all the luxuries. So
sure.
Yeah. So we were just sort of like, well, let's go back to New Hampshire. The job scene wasn't any better in New Hampshire. So actually it was pretty bad. We moved back and Mark was unemployed for, I think, 6 months. And I worked part time for, I don't know, like a year. I was working part time. And then we like unexpectedly found out we were pregnant. So it was a crazy time when we moved back.
But you were a teacher, right?
I was, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I was working part time as a teacher. I was a high school English teacher. And right out of college, I had worked at a boarding school for troubled teens. And when we moved back, they wanted me back. So, but they only had a part time. They could like cobble together a part time position. So, so I went back part time. And then eventually I went full time. But it was part time to start. So
it's interesting. So did you major in education or English?
I majored in English. It was technically called English teaching, so it was English with an emphasis on teaching. So.
Well, and I see, like in your email and when we were talking, you say you're the author behind Run Far Girl, which I think is interesting because people often refer to it as the blogger or like blogging. I like that you put author because, you know, it is your job, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of how I look at it. My approach to writing is probably, I see it like as a craft basically. And that's because that's how I was sort of taught, you know, that it is a craft. And, I was in college, I was surrounded by people who considered writing to be, a job, you know, mm-hmm. an occupation and a craft. And so that's sort of the approach that I have to it, I guess.
Now, did you start writing on Run Far Girl just to document your journey with running, or what made you want to start it?
Yeah, pretty much. So when we lived in Arizona, I was teaching, but I was also doing a little bit of freelance writing for some mostly print publications because I guess this was back in sort of 2006. So online really wasn't that, it wasn't a huge publishing space as it like it is now. So I was doing some freelance writing for print publications, and then when we moved back and I was teaching, I did a lot of sort of writing through that period of time. And then I had Sophia and I was staying at home, and I just needed sort of an outlet. It's crazy when you have your first kid, mm-hmm. like how much free time you have on your hands. So I just pretty much just spent like nap times. Like when she napped, I would just sit down and write. And it was just sort of an outlet of like talking about this new experience, motherhood. And also I had sort of stopped running for a period of time. There was about 3 years where I didn't run, and I was starting to sort of get back into it. So I was sort of writing about both things, like how running was helping me balance being a new mother and coping with that big change. And then, yeah, So
now why'd you stop running and why'd you start again?
So let's see. So I started running initially. I started running like my freshman year of college was when I really sort of got into it and wanted to run a marathon. That was like why I started running. Mm-hmm. So it was just like a bucket list thing. Like, I want to run a marathon and, I'll run it and then I'll be done and then I'll move on to the next thing on my bucket list. But I kind of got hooked. And so I'd run off and on. I ran my first marathon in 2003 and then did a couple more while we were in Arizona. And then I just got to a point where I was just really discouraged that I wasn't making any progress and I wasn't really enjoying it anymore. And I think part of that was I was struggling with bulimia at the time. And so I just really wasn't healthy. And so my running was suffering because of that. And it just wasn't enjoyable. And so I just pretty much stopped running. I mean, I still went to the gym, but I would, get on the elliptical or lift weights or take a class or something like that. And basically just, stopped running. So then when I had Sophia, my sister-in-law, shortly after I had Sophia, my sister-in-law ran her first marathon and we went to go and cheer her on. And just being in that race environment again, I was like, oh, I feel like I have unfinished business with this marathon thing. Like I really want to do it and have it feel good because all of my marathons have been pretty miserable experiences up until that point. So so I kind of caught the bug again and that's when I started running.
Now you, you openly share about your past with anorexia and bulimia on your,
yep,
on Run Far Girl. And, walk me through that a little bit. When did you first start struggling with that and how, a 9-year battle, that's a long time. How do you find freedom from that? Like how did it eventually work for you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it definitely, I think it started, at least the source of it, I would say started pretty young. As a kid, I like 10, 11 years old, I was overweight and just remember being made fun of, by other kids and also remember, being at the pediatrician and the pediatrician sort of calling my mom in and it being like this thing that, Sarah really should eat healthier. Her weight is kind of, she's heavy for her age and height. And so I think that sort of was really sort of the source of shame, just feeling like there's something wrong with me. And then in high school, I was kind of awkward and a loner in high school. And so I think I was just really self-conscious of my weight and my appearance and felt like I would be rejected. So I tended to just keep to myself. And then my junior and senior year, I just started skipping lunches because I just didn't want to have to deal with walking into the cafeteria and having nobody to sit with. So I would just sign myself out to the library and go to the library and study. And then I just wouldn't eat lunch. And so I actually started to lose weight sort of that I guess it was more my sophomore year that I dropped some weight. At the time I was kind of reading, all the glossy magazines or, like about weight loss, like what are the weight loss tricks and tips and stuff like that. And, just tried different things like no fat and, basically probably just lived on rice cakes and carrots and fat free, yogurt, aspartame, fat free, sugar free, those types of things. So, I just sort of had some extremes in my diet in high school, just trying to lose weight. And as I lost weight, I felt like people sort of responded positively. So at the time I wasn't a runner in high school, but I did play basketball and I was pretty competitive. I played, you know, on the high school team and then played AAU and some other stuff like that. And, you know, I was getting faster and more. So I got more playing time. My coaches were noticing, you know, that I was doing better on the court and stuff like that. So, so I was getting like positively reinforced for losing weight. And I think what really sort of when it really, I guess, took off, you could say, was, or where it became somewhat extreme was, the, I guess it was that, so it was the summer after I graduated from from high school, you know, getting ready to go off to college. And I felt like I wanted to sort of reinvent myself and be a different person in college. And, for me, like part of that was I wanted to be more outgoing. I didn't want to sort of be the wallflower that I was in high school. So, and then the other part of that was I wanted to lose weight and be thin and, you know, be, cause I had started high school overweight, but sort of finished like on the thinner side. So I wanted to start college like thin, that would be who people knew me as, was, you know, for my basically my appearance. So, the summer between my, the end of high school and going off to college, I, you know, focused on like a number that I wanted to be at before I went off to school. And, my first year was actually at Syracuse University. And it's about 7 hours from 7 hour drive from where we're at in New Hampshire, at least where my parents are at. And, I was really far away from home. And just had, I was connecting with other people, but at the same time, I was still really keeping to myself. And I just sort of got really restrictive, really excessive with exercise. I was running some, but it was all at the gym. I would mostly just spend a lot of time on the elliptical. Mm-hmm. You know, just, I was counting calories, monitoring how many calories I was taking in and, you know, how many calories I was burning at the gym. And actually at the time I was a nutritional science major and my initial intent was to become a registered dietitian. That was what I wanted to go to school for. And so I was in a really sort of twisted way. I was using everything that I was learning in all of my courses to sort of turn my weight loss into a science, basically. Like I had calculated out how many calories I burned in my sleep and how many calories I was burning during the day and, you know, was eating the minimum amount of calories to equate to a pound of weight loss a week, which is really extreme. Mm-hmm. And I was just, you know, became super restrictive in between. And I was already pretty thin when I went off to college, but between September and Christmas break, I lost about 20 pounds.
Wow.
Off an already thin frame and came home at Christmas. And, you know, at the time during, like when I came home at Christmas, I basically had all the symptoms of anorexia. My hair was falling out. My skin was just this sort of grayish, pale color. And I was constantly cold. Like no matter how many layers I put on, I was just constantly cold. And I couldn't sleep. Like that was probably the biggest thing was that I had sort of found a way, because I was doing a lot of fasting and I had sort of found a way to mentally, I guess, embrace hunger and like the hunger pangs as being like a sign of success. And it's really just one of those super twisted things that the mind of someone with an eating disorder does is that they turn things that are somewhat, you know, like a signal to your body that you need food. And then they, like I had sort of turned that into like a gratifying feeling, like I'm hungry. This is a sign that I'm winning, you know? Mm-hmm. So it got so twisted. I came home at Christmas and I was just miserable. Like I couldn't sleep at night 'cause I was hungry, but I was also, my mind was just racing with, you know, obsessive thoughts about how many calories did I eat, and did I, you know, so I ate 200 more calories yesterday. So that means I have to take 200 calories off tomorrow. You know, I was just like carrying over this deficit to the next day. You know, and I would obsess over when I was going to eat, what I was going to eat, if someone was going to notice, you know, I was just, my mind wouldn't be quiet. And so that's part of the reason why I couldn't sleep, was that my mind was just consumed with these obsessive thoughts. So I got home at Christmas, and it was actually Christmas Eve. We were headed to the Christmas Eve service at my parents' church, and I basically just broke down to my mom and I said, I think I have a problem. Like, I can't sleep. I can't, my hair is falling out. I'm cold, you know? And so she's like, yeah, you know, your dad and I are really worried. But I think they didn't know what to say or how to approach it. Like, it was pretty obvious that I had lost too much weight, and that I was extremely thin. But they, I don't know if they were afraid to say something or what, but yeah, I eventually said to my mom, like, I can't, like, I want to die. Like, I don't want to live like this because I'm so miserable. And so that was a turning point. That was like basically the first step towards recovery. But then that sort of turned into, you know, that was the first step, was, okay, I have a problem, admitting that I had a problem. But it was really just the beginning, because then, you know, so I got the official diagnosis and, started to seek help, when I went back to school after break. You know, I was seeing a therapist and had regular sessions with a nutritionist. But I just was still, like, I gained weight initially, but then sort of regressed back and lost a whole bunch of weight again. And then when I came home for the summer, I was on a waiting list for an outpatient clinic. And because I think my parents' insurance would cover outpatient, but they wouldn't cover like an inpatient. There are lots of really great facilities all across the country where you can sort of, it's like a retreat, sort of, you just go, you can be a patient. It's not like a retreat, but it's like a facility where you would go and stay, and receive treatment, for weeks or months at a time, which I probably could have benefited from, but, I ended up, you know, on this wait list for an outpatient facility. And, yeah, my health just sort of deteriorated pretty quickly again, lost more weight. And then, I think in my mind, I was afraid that once I got into the clinic, they would make me gain weight. So I wanted to like lose weight before I got to the clinic. Mm-hmm. Like I was just so, like, my thinking was just so twisted. And then once I eventually started, you know, to recover and eat and sort of follow the rules, I started to struggle with bulimia, because on the outside, everyone was looking to see if I was eating. Mm-hmm. So I felt this sort of external pressure to eat. So I would eat, but then behind closed doors, I would just go and purge. And so that lasted for, excuse me, for 8 years. So the anorexia was basically a year. I would say my freshman year of college, but it probably started prior to that, more into high school. But
yeah, all those years leading up to it, when you were kind of teaching yourself how to do it almost.
Yeah, basically. Because the disordered eating and the disordered thinking started long before my freshman year of college. So
do you think,
but really, so go ahead.
I was just gonna say, do you think, I'm just thinking all the way back to when you were a kid and you were mm-hmm. overweight, and the pediatrician, you know, talked to your mom about that. did she, were you in the room with the doctor when she talked to her about it?
Yeah.
You know, I actually have a friend who has two daughters and a son, and her daughter, I mean, gosh, you don't even want to say her daughter's overweight, but her daughter's like, you know, whatever on the charts, a little bit over what they're supposed to be. And she had, the doctor had her leave the room and talk to the mom about that. What's your opinion on that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's such a sensitive topic because, I mean, I remember being there, and then I remember it felt like everybody in my family knew, like even my grandparents knew, because as a 10-year-old, I remember going and staying with my grandparents, and my grandmother weighed me, like, to check my weight, and that was, like, I remember being really self-conscious of that. But, yeah, I just felt like everyone knew. So, I think it's just such a tough, like, because she's got to know, like, if the doctor says, okay, you can go out to the waiting room and talk to your mom now.
Yeah, because she's, like, 11.
She's got to know that something's going on. But, I don't know. I mean, I think it's tough because, you know, we do, you know, there's this, a lot of talk about this, you know, the obesity epidemic in the U.S. And I think for the most part, I probably, if it had never been addressed, I think I would have just grown out of it. Cause I was like squat and short as a kid. And then I like in eighth grade, I shot right up. So, you know, I think in some ways it probably would have just evened itself out. But on its own, if it hadn't been an issue, but yeah, I don't know. It's a fine line to walk because you don't know how that's going to affect the kid, you know, if you were to bring that up.
Yeah. I mean, you have to think about it, but gosh, you got to tread so lightly on how you address it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did now where in this process, I mean, you and your husband both grew up in New Hampshire. So how old were you when you guys started dating?
Yeah. So it's kind of funny cause we actually went to the same high school, but, he was a senior and I was a freshman. So our paths never really crossed. And then I met him, let's see. So my freshman year was at Syracuse. And then basically that spring, my parents and I, it was mostly my parents decided that I needed to transfer to be closer to home. I mean, I knew it was the right choice, but I kept going back and forth and I couldn't make a decision. So finally my dad stepped in. He's like, Sarah, I think you just need to come home. So I ended up transferring to the University of New Hampshire, which is about 20 minutes from where my parents live. So I transferred there and, Mark, my husband was a student there, but he was also friends with my older brother, and my older brother didn't go to UNH, but he was living on campus with some friends over the summer. And, Mark happened to hang out with them a lot. And so my brother sort of introduced us, and then we started dating when I was 19. So, yeah.
So was that when you were in the thick of it?
Yeah. 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 And actually, I had been dating a guy from Syracuse, and, we were trying to like do like a long distance thing. And, I met Mark. We actually went hiking together. That was sort of the first time that we spent time together. And on the way home, like he was in my car and I was driving a group of people home and I dropped off all the other people and he was sitting in my car. And, somehow for whatever reason, I opened up to him and, you know, said, I'm actually struggling with an eating disorder. And I can't remember how that came up, but it did. And I was really, at the time I was pretty shy and pretty private. And I was kind of shocked at myself for opening up to this guy. And, he said to me, he was like, so what are you doing to get better? Mm. And at first I was super pissed. Like, who are you to challenge me on this? You don't even know me. I just met you. Like, I would never say any of that stuff out loud. Cause that's just, I'm not super confrontational, but that's what I was thinking. And I was really mad when I got home, but, I actually really liked that quality in him that he was challenging me. And, So I actually ended up breaking up with the guy who I had been dating because I felt like he, when I told him that I was struggling, he was like, said nothing. And it was just like this thing we never talked about. But I just really appreciated that about Mark, that he, and I said, that's one of the qualities I still appreciate about him, is that he always challenges me to be, you know, a better person. So
was he a big part of the healing process there and in moving on from it?
Definitely. Yeah. So we started dating the fall of my sophomore year. So as I'm, you know, I've just transferred, it's my sophomore year. We start dating. He was coming to therapy sessions with me. He was, you know, really supporting the process and, you know, whatever he could do. And I think as the eating disorder progressed, I think he was just in a really tough position, you know, because he really loved me, but he really wanted me to get better as well. So we, you know, there were times when he tried like tough love, you know, and just like lay down the law and be like, you have to change and stuff like that. And then that sort of didn't work. And I think eventually he just, like the further it progressed, like, so let's see, in terms of years. So that was like year one. So 8 more years of me, you know, being bulimic and, you know, having this sort of secretive habit that I was trying to hide from him. I mean, he knew it was going on all along, but, you know, I think he just got really tired of and didn't know what to do, you know? So, so I think he just kind of got to a point where he was like, well, I'm just gonna, and I'm sort of getting emotional, but yeah, I'm just gonna love her through it. So, you know, and he's been by me the whole time, so.
It's hard for me not to cry when I hear you cry.
Yeah, I mean, he's a huge reason why I got better. He's seen the worst of it, you know. And, yeah.
Like, what in your relationship, at what point it was it just like something's got to give? Like, what was the breaking point that you were like, I got to get free from this? And how did you do it?
Yeah, so I think with recovery from an eating disorder, there's multiple points where you feel that way. I think, you know, the way that recovery works, it's like 3 steps forward and then 2 steps back and then 3 steps forward and 2 steps back. So there's always like progress and then relapse and then progress and relapse. And I really struggled with that aspect of it because I have a sort of perfectionistic nature. So, you know, I wanted it to just be progress, progress, progress without any relapse. And so to me, relapse just felt like the end of the world. So I think, you know, there were just several different turning points that were, I guess you could say they were sort of pivotal moments. And the first one was I was at like a retreat in Arizona, and it was at a monastery, and we had this time, this quiet time to just go and walk through the gardens at the monastery, and it was supposed to be just silence. We weren't supposed to talk or anything like that. And so I was walking around the monastery, and I had this sort of picture in my mind of a potter sitting at a potter's wheel, and he was molding this clay on the potter's wheel, and the clay got off center and got all messed up. You know, the pot that he was working on got all messed up, but he took the clay, put it back on, centered it again, and then was able to mold this just like beautiful piece of pottery. And so I felt so much shame about my eating disorder. And it was sort of, and my eating disorder was born out of the shame of sort of being made fun of and being overweight. And so I just felt messed up. Like I felt pretty much like a failure. And so that picture, like I felt like, okay, maybe I'm not perfect, but I can still be a work of art. And so I felt like that was a pivotal moment where I sort of changed the way that I looked at myself. Like, I'm not, you know, when I looked in the mirror, I always saw like what was wrong. And so I started to, my outlook on myself started to shift and change, where I started to view myself in a more positive light, because there was basically years of just a negative narrative that had run through my head of like negative thoughts about myself that sort of fed the eating disorder. So I feel like a shift in that, in the way that I viewed myself, was key. So that was a pivotal moment. Another moment was actually when I found out that I was pregnant. I had been told early on that I probably would have trouble conceiving just because of my history, with anorexia, and I didn't have a regular period. And so, the doctors, I had spoken to several doctors. Mark and I had been married about 5 years. So we were, you know, thinking about kids. So I talked to the doctor, like, what's the process? Like, what, you know, I've been told that I'm going to have trouble. And he's like, well, we'll just wait and see, but I think you'll probably need some sort of intervention. We moved back from Arizona to New Hampshire. Mark was unemployed. I was part-time. So we actually didn't have any health insurance at the time. And my birth control ran out, my prescription ran out, and I didn't have a PCP to go see to get it renewed. And so I just stopped. I was like, well, I probably am not going to get pregnant anyway, so I'll just stop, you know, and I'll just deal with it later. And so I actually ended up getting pregnant, and I went and got that confirmed. And, you know, as I was getting in the car after, you know, up until like, so I found out they had realized that I was 7 weeks pregnant. So it was a little bit probably further along, but than most people are when they initially take like a home pregnancy test. And, you know, I had, for the last few weeks, I'd been binging and purging. And so I realized like I've been doing this while I've been pregnant, and I didn't know it. And I just felt like this can't happen anymore. And I can remember just having this sort of image flash in front of my, in my head, that of me behind a locked bathroom door and a little toddler, and it was a girl. I didn't know I was having a girl, but in this like picture in my head, it was a girl, was on the other side of the locked bathroom door, you know, calling for mommy and mommy. And I was in the bathroom, you know, purging behind the locked bathroom door. And that picture just wrecked me. Like, I just was like, I can't keep doing this. Like, that's not the story. That's not the life I want to live. I can stop. I can prevent that picture from coming true. Is sort of how I felt in that moment. And so, so that was like probably one of the final turning points. And, I sort of made this weird bargain with myself. You know, and all through those years, all through those 8 years, 9 years of struggling, I was seeing a therapist. Like, I went through a couple different ones. Like, I was seeing a therapist. I was doing a lot of journaling. Like, I was doing everything that I felt I could to, you know, I had friends who were helping keep me accountable. You know, I was doing everything I could to recover, but I just wasn't getting there. Like, I just wasn't happening. So when I found out I was pregnant and I just felt like I couldn't continue. And so I sort of made this weird bargain with myself that I wasn't going to, for 9 months, I wasn't going to purge, no matter how much I wanted to, no matter how much food I'd had or how uncomfortable I felt. I wasn't going to purge, just because I wanted this baby to be healthy. But then if I got to the end of 9 months and had the baby and wanted to lose the baby weight and felt like the only way I could lose the baby weight was by going back to my old habits, then, well, that was that. And that's what would happen. And I could do that. And so I felt like I kind of knew in the back of my mind, like, if I can make it 21 days or if I can make it, you know, a few months without purging, then I think I'm at the point where that like habit thing will kick in and I will be able to overcome this negative behavior and, you know, not feel the compulsion to do it anymore. Because you get to a point where you just, you feel so out of control of your own behavior that it's just, it's a compulsion that you can't even control, really. It becomes almost like an addiction. And so actually treating it like an addiction, I read the 12 Steps Anorexic and Bulimics Anonymous, that book, and worked through the 12 steps. That was also another pivotal turning point. But when I started to treat it as an addiction, that was helpful as well. Just because the behavior is so compulsive. So we got into the, you know, I was pregnant. The first few months were just really difficult, you know, because I had to sort of relearn how to eat. There were times when I did binge and I overate and I just had to sit with it. And it was really, really uncomfortable and really difficult. But I got about 3 months in where I hadn't purged in like 3 months. And that's really where I started to sort of relearn how to eat, like how to eat intuitively, how to listen to hunger cues and sort of, so it was like a twofold process where I had to like break the habit of binging and purging, but I also had to relearn how to feed my body properly because it'd been so long since that had happened. The further I got away from that last binge and purge, the more I felt like I don't ever want to go back to that. And so when Sophia was born, you know, I basically felt like a new person. Like I felt totally different. Like my way, my approach to food was different. My outlook on life was different. I was more engaged with the people around me because one of the things that happens when you're struggling with an eating disorder is that you just get really isolated and secretive and you just don't engage with people. You don't talk to people. You don't like my mind was constantly preoccupied. So if I was talking to you, my mind would be somewhere else. It would be thinking about what I just ate and how I was going to get rid of it and not necessarily on the conversation I was having with someone. So I just felt like I felt engaged with life. Like before I just felt like I was just sort of passively moving through life in this really miserable existence. And then after I had sort of overcome things and broken that habit, yeah, I just felt like a totally different person.
I mean, gosh, you were married for a long time before. I mean, not a long time, but I mean, you were walking through that for the first 5 years of your marriage. It sounds like having Sophia was kind of like your breakthrough.
Yeah, I think it really was just... I think too, so at the time I was about to turn 28. So I was 27 when Sophia was born. I think there was too just this realization that it's not about me anymore. Mm-hmm. I think that can sometimes come with age a little bit where, yeah, I just realized like I can't do this. Like I can't live in this way where I block everyone else out, you know, including my husband, where I block everyone else out and just focus on how food affects me and how I feel about my body. And yeah, it was just a really sort of selfish place to exist. And I think when I realized I was pregnant, it was kind of like a very big wake up call to the fact that it wasn't just about me. Yeah.
You mentioned the 12-step program for anorexia and bulimia, and I was talking to my husband, you know, just about our conversation beforehand, and we were talking about how we wondered if people felt like it was kind of like similar to alcoholism? Like, are you, you know, it's something that you have to, is it something that you have to consciously walk through even now that you're recovered?
Now that I'm recovered, I don't feel like I don't have to be conscious around food. I feel like I've gotten to a point where everything around food and exercise is intuitive and it's healthy. Mm-hmm. So I think in that regard, it's very different from alcohol. It's not like, you know, with alcohol, a lot of people, they have to abstain for the rest of their lives, basically. So in that regard, it's different. But I think in terms of just the addictive, what happens in the brain with addiction, I think is very similar. Mm-hmm. So you're not necessarily using a substance, you know, with drug or alcohol addiction, but the same pathways, and are sort of being accessed, when you have this sort of disordered, thinking that results in an eating disorder. And a lot of times they stem from similar places. So, you know, a lot of addiction, drug and alcohol addiction, stems from hurt and shame in the past, you know, and eating disorders oftentimes are a result of hurt and shame in the past. And just, you know, people sort of have found different coping mechanisms. I probably, like, if I wasn't the perfectionistic good girl rule follower that I was sort of growing up, I probably would have ended up with probably some sort of substance abuse problem. But it manifested as an eating disorder instead, probably because I was too afraid of doing something wrong. So, but yeah, I think like treating it as an addiction was really helpful for me, because the first step is to realize that you're powerless over your addiction. And so I think for an eating disorder, a lot of it is about control. It's about controlling food and weight and things like that. And so when you're admitting that you have no control and that you're powerless, that's kind of a powerful place to start from, in terms of recovery.
Do you, you know, you got emotional and talked about your husband kind of being there with you through everything and being a big part of the reason you were able to recover. And do you guys ever kind of just like look at each other and think, we did it, like we got through it?
So it's been 8 years that I've been recovered. And I think earlier on, the memory of what it used to be like was still pretty fresh in my mind. And, you know, I would say stuff like, can you remember like how miserable I was? And he was like, yep.
I was there.
Yep, I know. So, but I don't know. We don't do that as often now. 'Cause I think too, like now that we have three kids, we can't even remember what it was like before having kids.
Yeah. So,
you know, it's like, it's a pretty distant memory now. But you know, there's things like I could never enjoy vacations before, you know, just because vacation just sort of centers around food and it's a new environment and I didn't know where I was going to be able to purge and, you know, so it was just messed up. But now, you know, vacation is vacation and I can be, you know, a happy, healthy person.
Yeah.
So
now this is kind of a segue, and I'm thinking back to when you were, talking about, you know, when all this stemmed from little girl in the doctor's office, and then, you know, in high school, not having a place and feeling, you know, like going to the library and skipping lunch so that you didn't have to deal with seeing people. Does your experience with all of that have anything to do with why you've chosen to homeschool?
No, not really. Okay. No, the homeschooling is more, just, we really wanted the freedom of, sort of the schedule and also just be able to sort of cater to the kids' educational needs and, you know, be able to be more active and not necessarily sit in the classroom all day, that kind of thing.
Now tell me about it a little bit. Sophia's 7.
Yep.
Jack is four?
Jack is 4. He's like 4 and a half. Okay. And then Liam is 23 months this month.
So he's almost 2.
I know. Yeah, it's kind of crazy because we're in a transition period here. So we're building a house and living temporarily at my mother-in-law's beach house. So this year we're kind of being very relaxed with school. So Sophia was in first grade last year. And we're like first and a half grade, I would say. Like some of the stuff she's doing is second grade, some of the stuff she's doing is first grade. And that's actually pretty common for homeschoolers. Kids are sort of never really know what grade they're in because mm-hmm. they're doing a bunch of different stuff. So, so she's kind of, we just kind of pick and choose what works for her and plays to her strengths. So she's like second-ish grade. And then Jack is just preschool. So, you know, with him, we're just doing just sort of fun stuff with letters and numbers and counting and that kind of thing. And then Liam just, you know,
hangs out.
Just does his thing. Yeah, he just hangs out.
So, Sophia, I mean, is it like, tell me what kind of structure you set him for, you know, because I'm picturing, you know, I have three kids. Younger than you. Mine are younger, like 4, 2, and baby. So, you know, my 4-year-old's in pre-K and he does go full day, and that's mostly for my sanity more than anything. I don't think he needs to be in school full day. It's very play-based. His school is kind of a mix between, it's a Reggio, like based school. So it's a mix between Montessori and regular school. It's somewhere in the middle. But anyway, he's going to go to pre-K again next year, but I'm just thinking, man, we have to send him to a different school for a year because he can't go to the same pre-K twice. It's some weird thing with our public schools. But, I was thinking, what if I just kept him home for that next year of pre-K? And then, you know, we could really have this flexibility and do whatever we want. But then I'm like, oh my gosh, what would I do? Like, I would have to have structure and I would have no way to know what to do.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's tough. It's like a fine line between being structured and having a plan and also being flexible. But yeah, we work through, she's got math and like a language arts reading. We do history and science I do with Jack and Sophia. So
fun.
We like sort of roll that together, which is fun.
What curriculum do you use?
So I use a bunch of, you can buy whole package curriculums that have every subject and your teacher lesson plans and everything sort of laid out for you. What I ended up doing is just kind of piecing together resources that I liked. So we use a different math, language arts, and it's all different, but so it's not necessarily from one source. So I just pieced together some different stuff.
Now, if you were to ever decide, I think I want to take them to school and not do this homeschooling thing, how do you then...
Oh, like on Friday, I was ready to ship them off before you school.
I'm sure.
Yeah, we definitely have days where I'm like, I am not doing this.
Yeah.
But
I don't know. You know. I mean, I think it takes a special kind of person to be able to do it in the first place.
Yeah, and sometimes I think I'm not that special person. So, I don't know. We'll see. I mean, we have good days and we have bad days, but I think it's tough because the town where we're building our house doesn't necessarily have the best schools, so I probably wouldn't want to send the kids there.
Yeah.
There are some private school options, but then, you know, that affects your budget as well. So,
totally.
So I don't know. I mean, I don't know. Right now, we're probably going to stick it out for a little bit longer and just see how it goes.
Would you like to think that you want to be committed through like high school even?
No. I mean, my husband Mark would. He totally, like, if we could switch spots and he could stay home and homeschool the kids and I could work full time, we would totally switch. Mm-hmm. So, but it's not super realistic at this point. But
I can't wrap my head around it. My aunt homeschooled all three of her kids through high school, and but that, you know, they were a part of this big And I'm sure you've heard all about it. So like once they got to the higher classes, mm-hmm. you know, they would be going somewhere else. Like she wasn't teaching her junior and high school math.
Yeah. Yeah. And we were part of a co-op for Sophia's kindergarten and first grade year. And it got to a point where it was just a little too much because I was having to teach a class. That's the thing is when mm-hmm. you're in a co-op, you can't just, you have to contribute. So I was teaching a class and it was just a lot of prep work and a lot and with time that I just felt like I didn't have. So I think maybe we'll revisit the co-op at some point, but we also have a really great children's museum here and they offer homeschool classes. Sophia's participated in some of their science classes, which is a great resource. And we've also toyed with the idea of getting a tutor as well for Sophia to just sort of help with the uh-huh. load, I guess. Cause sometimes I do feel really overwhelmed cause I do a lot of other stuff like the freelance writing that I'm doing and the retreat that I put on and, you know, I can't do it all. So we're going to need some help at some point. I'm not really sure what it's going to look like, but,
Okay, everybody, I want to take a quick break and tell you about the Runner's World Women's Getaway at the Westin Riverfront Resort and Spa at Beaver Creek Mountain in Avon, Colorado, May 18th through the 21st. Runner's World has the perfect concept for a getaway with your girlfriends. And guess who's going to be there? Shalane Flanagan and Elise Kopecky. There will be daily guided runs, running and nutrition workshops, the opportunity to meet and mingle with Runner's World editors and guests, yoga, all kinds of awesome stuff. And hey, you guys know 2017 is all about that self-care, right? I laugh because I make fun of the term self-care. But that being said, though I make fun of that term, I truly and honestly believe it's so important to get away and recharge. And Runner's World has come up with the perfect concept for that. So go hang out with Shalane Flanagan. That sounds amazing. And run wild with your girlfriends. You guys can get more information on the event if you just go to the show notes of this episode at lindseyhine.com, I'll have a link to that in the bottom of the show notes. And you guys can also email Runner's World getaway at runnersworld.com for more information. Okay, let's go ahead and continue my conversation with Sarah. Now, speaking of all that and just picturing you, you know, kind of explaining your day, do you always do your runs or workouts early morning?
And I do.
During the week, you do?
Yeah. Yeah, during the week and even on the weekends too, because usually we've got something going on as a family. So I just try to make sure that my running is the least disruptive as possible. In the summer when I can get the kids out in the stroller, mm-hmm. and Sophia's fast enough on her bike that she can ride.
Oh, that's so fun.
Bike. Yeah, she can ride her bike next to me, and I can have the double. If she's riding her bike, we're not going to do much more than maybe 3 miles is probably her top. So, really that's my only option is to get out in the morning pretty early. So I try to be back right before or right as everyone's getting up, which is, 7 is usually when everyone's kind of rolling out of bed.
And do you feel comfortable running outside in the dark?
Yeah, I've gotten to a point. I mean, there are times when when it doesn't feel comfortable and I am a little concerned for my safety, but we live in a really safe area. But I always, you know, I try to take a self-defense class at least once a year. I should probably do it more frequently than that, but take a self-defense class. I always carry mace with me. I know that's some people don't think that that's a good tactic, but I carry it. I think it's helpful. So
yeah,
I actually
anything extra is helpful.
So, and there's a couple girls who run early who I can meet up with. Sometimes it doesn't always work out, but
you do see the, you know, obviously everybody's seen this circulating, the woman who was attacked in the bathroom Gosh, I always get nervous going into bathrooms like that though. I saw feet in there, I don't even know if I'd go in to the stall because I'd be like, who is that? What are they doing? I'm always on guard. Not to say she shouldn't have gone in there, but man, just the way she described it in that article when she was like, not today.
I know.
Would like to think that's how hard I would fight.
Yeah. Well, I think sometimes too, like a lot of times in the morning when I head out, I think like, okay, what would I do if mm-hmm. this happened?
Totally.
Like just to sort of be on my guard and mm-hmm. be aware. And, you know, I don't listen to music, mm-hmm. but I watch cars, like, mm-hmm. you know, if I see, you know, kind of memorize the cars that I do see when I'm out there.
Totally.
And try to get familiar, with those. And then, you know, too, just varying my route and where I go and, you know, how long I'm out there, I think is helpful as well. So
yeah, when I'm out running, even if it's like daylight and it's sort of busy or whatever, if there's a car that like pulls up next to me or like turns around out of a driveway yeah. to like, I'm always like really staring them down. Like, I'm watching you, buddy. Mm-hmm. I don't know who you are. I can't even tell if you're male or female yet, but I'm yeah. watching you.
Yeah. There was one time last fall where I was running and it was actually in the evening. It was right after the time changed. Mm-hmm. So it was like, if I had gone the night before, it would have been light, but then that night it was dark because the time changed. And I was running and there was this van that was sort of slowed way down, just got super creepy. And I just pretended that I was home and like walked up this driveway like I was going into this, like, this is my house. Mm-hmm. And then I just like waited by these people's bushes. I don't even know who they are. And until the van like was gone and like, I felt like, okay, I think it's gone. And then I just bolted home yeah. as fast as I could. So I wasn't too far from home. I was maybe a mile and a half from home. So, yeah. But yeah, I think you just have to trust your gut instinct and just listen to that. It's probably the best thing.
Well, yeah. And it's also like, it is so tragic when something happens, you know, whether it's somebody, a runner out getting hit by a car or, you know, mm-hmm. the unfortunate situation where these girls, it seemed like it was happening a lot over the summer, mm-hmm. being murdered when they were out running, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. But that being said, you know, I just talked to one of my most recent interviews, Mary Catherine Hamm. Her mm-hmm. husband lost his life in a biking accident. And it's
yeah,
like,
I'd sit to that one.
Yeah, and it's just like, you know, one thing she
and
was
he was
saying,
in a race, right? It was a race setting.
It was
yeah.
like, it was like a charity bike ride. Mm-hmm. But one thing that she said that really like spoke to me was just, you know, like the thought of, because he was such an adventurous person, like the thought of her changing the way her and her girls lived their life because she was living fearfully because what could happen.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he would never want that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's yeah. not to say that you can't be cautious and can't be careful, but just to not do something that you love because you're scared. I mean, there's a lot to be said for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree. I totally agree.
So I kind of want to talk about your, there's lots of different things here, your snowshoe running, your mountain running, but, I want to talk about your retreat that you do.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about that. Yeah. So, Rise Run Retreat is the retreat. And we're in our third year, and I put it on with Jessica from runladylike.com.
Oh, yeah, I know this.
Yeah, she and I met. So we met online just through social, mm-hmm. and then we ended up going to Fit Blogging together in Savannah. And we were driving back to the airport from after Fit Blogging, and we were just talking about, man, wouldn't it be great? Because we met some really amazing people. And but Fit Blogging was pretty big at that point. It was, you know, tons of people, you know, at a big hotel. You would kind of connect with just a few, like a small group of people, but it was hard to connect with everyone, mm-hmm. Impossible to connect with everyone. And so we were kind of like, wouldn't it be great if we could bring together all the cool people that we met or, you know, have a reason to get together. And so it was sort of born out of that conversation. The retreat itself is pretty small. It's limited to 10 women.
Wow.
And so far we've held it in the Northeast. We've been on the beach in Maine. Last year we were in the mountains in Vermont. And this year we're going to be on a lake in New Hampshire. And so it's just a weekend of running and relationships. And we throw in some really fun activities. Last year in Vermont, we had a great cross-training session with Crystal Seaver. So she was there. She did a cross-training session with us. We had a registered dietitian come and talk about nutrition specific to women's running and women's nutrition, which was super informative. And it was great because it's such a small group that she could do Q&A afterwards, and it was very individualized questions. So people were asking like really specific stuff and getting really specific personalized answers. So that was kind of cool. And then Cabot Cheese came and they did a beer, wine, and cheese pairing, which was super fun. And then we had our guest speaker last year was Sherry Pierce, and she's an elite runner, a master's elite runner, and she's run in like 3 Olympic trials.
Now, she's not the one.
She's incredible.
There's somebody that I've recently seen articles about eating candy before they run. Is that her?
Yep, that's Sherry. Yeah, okay. She eats candy and drinks Sunkist before her runs. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, she's recently so gotten some buzz.
Yeah, she was awesome. Super down to earth. She's a mom of 3. But yeah, she was great. And then, we just had some really great programming. Lots of little sessions for everyone to participate in. And then we run each day, and we did yoga. We had the cross training session. And so this year it'll be pretty similar. We've got some great guest speaker, an inspirational guest speaker coming in, and a sports psychologist. We're going to do some really fun stand-up paddleboard yoga.
Oh, fun.
Yeah, so it's going to be some trail runs because we're in a location that has some great trails. Yeah, it's going to be a really fun weekend.
So is the target number 10 because just so that you can actually build those relationships and you don't get lost in the shuffle of all those people?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So I don't think it will ever get bigger than 10 people per retreat, but it's possible that we could then do multiple retreats
over
the course of a year. So there's just something really magical about that small number.
Uh-huh.
And it's just really neat to see everyone come together and then afterwards continue the relationships on. And like a lot of the girls who came last year, they're like running races together. They've gone off and sort of planned their own reunions and get togethers, and people were from all over the country. So
yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. It was just really neat to see so many different people come together.
Well, and I've never been to any of those like real blogging conferences or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And I know that they were real popular there for a while. But I did go to this, like an immersion event at Now Foods with like a bunch of Fitfluential people. And, I had never been to an event like that. I signed up for Fitfluential just to kind of like see what it was all about, because I always saw people talking about it. And then I saw this event and I thought, oh, this sounds kind of fun. Well, when I went there, it seemed like everybody knew each other. Mm. And I felt really like nobody was rude to me or anything like that, but I just felt like out of place. Like, do I belong here? Everybody knows each other. They've clearly been to events like this with each other before, and almost kind of clicky, without because anybody was trying to make it clicky. It just was. So that being said, there were a couple people that I got to know a little bit better than others. And so an event like what you do makes a lot of sense for, actually forming relationships.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I definitely think like the small number is key for that, because everyone, we bring everyone together for a welcome dinner at the beginning. And, we do kind of fun and quirky icebreakers and stuff like that. But, it's a small enough group where people really open up. And I feel like if it's any bigger, people tend to not open up and tend to stay just a little bit closed off and reserved. So,
totally.
It's a really good time. And, when it's that small, you can do a lot of things together. Like we all went out to dinner one night. So it's definitely a great experience.
And I met Angela.
Mm-hmm.
You guys are good friends, right?
Yeah. Angela lives pretty close by. So,
okay. So
yeah.
You actually
we try to run together when we get the chance.
Yeah, I met her at the Saucony 26 Strong project. She was one of the coaches with me, and we were both injured, so neither of us got to run the marathon. So we got to hang out that day and get to know each other. She's really nice.
Yeah, she's super sweet.
But she went to your retreat, right?
She did. Yeah, she's been to the last two. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's sweet. Okay. So, and before we move on to our fun questions at the end, real quick, tell me about snowshoe running.
Yeah.
So that's like your thing right now.
It is. It is my thing. So this is the first weekend in 5 weeks that I haven't had a race. So the last 5 weekends I've had races, some of which have been multiple races in a weekend. So it's like a doubleheader on Saturday and Sunday.
I mean, your pictures are beautiful, and I see all your stuff, and I'm like, oh my gosh, your pictures are so beautiful. It makes me want to actually live somewhere colder than I am now. But then I'm like, no, Lindsay, no, you don't.
Yeah, no. Because so the last race was last weekend, and I'm so over snow right now. Like, I just don't want to see another flake of snow. Because it's March and it should be spring, but it's not, because it snowed on, we had a huge nor'easter on Monday or Tuesday. So we got dumped with more snow on Tuesday. But so the snowshoe running, I started doing that about 3 years ago. It's kind of a thing here in the Northeast. There's a whole snowshoe federation. There's a whole snowshoe race series. So I had the chance to, this year I had the chance to go to the World Snowshoe Championships, which were in Saranac Lake, New York, which was fun. It ended up being a super weird weekend where it was almost 60 degrees and all their snow had melted. So it was more of like a mud run than it really was a snow run. But the snowshoe running is a great way to pass the winter and have a reason to get outside and get a good workout in. It's lots of great leg strength, just because your stride is a little bit more exaggerated. So you're lifting your knees higher, and your stance is a little bit wider, but, so it's a great strength workout as well as, cardio. Your heart rate gets up super high. It's really hard work, but, so you can feel, you can be going basically like a 10, 12 minute pace and feel like you're running 5K pace effort. Your heart rate just gets skyrockets.
Are you wearing ski looking things on your feet? Like, what's on your feet?
Yeah. So there are special snowshoes that are made especially for running.
Okay.
The ones that I wear are Dion snowshoes, and they're primarily they're the major sponsor of all the races, and they're primarily the best running snowshoes out there. They're made in Vermont, and the guy who makes them shows up to all the races too. He's pretty cool. He's kind of a fun guy.
So when you enter a snowshoe race, are you, do you get, everybody gets race nerves when they're about to run a half marathon or whatever. Do you get the same kind of nerves you get in a running race?
Not really. It's a little bit more laid back and more fun.
Yeah. Kind of like trail running.
It's kind of the same vibe as the trail running and ultra, community, I would say. So it's pretty relaxed. Everyone's, it's hard for everyone. So everyone is struggling, but out there to just have fun and play in the snow. And, it's a fun vibe.
Okay. So do you think you'll ever get back to wanting to do racing marathons and cutting your time down in that? Or are you kind of just happy where you're at in this ultra mountain snowshoe scene?
I don't know. I can't say never, but I feel like I'm happy where I'm at. I'm not sure. I'm not itching to get back to the road marathon at all. I'd like to see what I can do on the mountain running series. So I'm signed up for the USATF New England mountain running series this summer. It's spring and summer, And actually, there's a couple fall races, but I'll do that. I'll run in the U.S. Mountain Running Championships again this June. So yeah, I'm pretty happy to just kind of hang out here right now. I just really like the race atmosphere. It's not quite as serious as the road, not quite as cutthroat. So it's a lot more relaxed.
But when you get out there, do you get competitive? I mean,
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And everybody else is, but you're all friends before and after and
right.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It's just fun.
Well, there's lots of other things I'd like to get into, but we're like hour 17 already.
I know.
That's
we're going
okay though.
Kind of long here, but yeah, that's okay.
Yeah, I'm totally fine with that. I try to keep them between an hour, hour and a half, so we're good. So okay, let's get to some fun questions here at the end.
Okay.
What is the best advice you've ever been given?
Yeah. Okay. So this one was from my grandfather. He passed away a few years ago, and my sister and I actually had the chance to. He was pretty healthy, and then his health deteriorated pretty quickly. She and I had the chance to go down and basically say goodbye. When we were there with him, he said to me. I'm going to have a hard time saying this. He said to me, of my grandmother, he said, "I wish I had greeted her with more wonder each morning."
Mm.
And I just felt like that was such a beautiful thing, first of all, but also just such a wise thing. Like, I feel like if I can greet my husband, if I can greet my children with wonder, each morning, and even strangers who I encounter mm-hmm. during the day, if I can greet people with wonder, you know, I feel like you're focused more on sort of, I don't know, the mystery and the uniqueness of who they are, and not necessarily like, oh my gosh, I have to make you pancakes for breakfast, or like, you know, go wash your hands. You know, if like a lot of times in the morning, the kids all come out and it's like a mad rush mm-hmm. for, you know, I want yogurt and I want cereal and I want this and I want that. And so you don't ever really like take that moment to sort of, I don't know, see them for who they are. So I don't know. That's probably the best advice.
That is so good. I've been thinking yeah. about that, so, not that exact quote, because I've never heard that quote and I really think it's beautiful, but for a good year, I had been getting super frustrated with my oldest because he mm-hmm. would just keep getting up so early. And,
yeah.
you know, and then I would get up early and I would be like, okay, but if I get up early, like, just because you sense that I'm up, please don't get up. Like, I want this.
I know.
Alone. You know, you're like, I want.
I put a towel against their door so they can't see any light. Nice. Like, I stuffed this towel.
That's a really
good
idea.
So there's no light going through underneath the door.
Because you're like, the only reason I'm getting up early is for this hour to myself.
Right.
Like, if I'm going to be waiting on people, I don't want actually to be up yet.
Yeah, like, why even bother?
Right. So, but I was thinking about it and, you know, I'm like, well, he's an early riser. He's not getting up at 5. It's like 6 or whatever. And I thought, man, Lindsay, like, do you really want his memory to be how annoyed my mom was every single morning when I got her up too early?
No.
And I can't change that he's an early riser, you know. We can discipline and say you have to stay in your room till this time and whatnot. And there's all kinds of things that you can do to address that. But I was just like, I've been making a conscious effort to greet him very pleasantly in the morning. Because I'm like, that's how I treat him the first, you know, few minutes of his day. Like, hopefully that will set the tone of the day. And yeah, there's probably going to be a temper tantrum at some point, but, you know, it's not foolproof, but yeah. And I like how your grandfather put that. That's really special.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if you could have coffee or cocktail with anybody, who would it be?
I think, I think I would want to see my grandfather again and talk to him again, mm-hmm. would be one choice. That's sort of like the more sentimental choice.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The more fun choice would be, we had a group of friends, who we used to, this was before we moved to Arizona, who we used to have dinner with pretty much once a month. And we went to this restaurant that had this table called the Mafia table. And it was like tucked in the back corner of the restaurant. We would always sit at this table. So I would have drinks with all of them at the Mafia table, like old times. It'd be super fun.
Are they just all scattered around the country now?
Yes. Well, and out of the country. One of my friends lives in Turkey. And then the other two live in Colorado. So,
man, that's a crazy place to live. My brother-in-law is from Turkey.
Oh, really?
Turkey would be a crazy place to be right now, I feel like.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
So what are you loving these days?
Yeah. So let's see. So I'm loving, Life in the Day. I don't know if you saw that. It's,
No, I don't know.
It's a Billy Yang film about Western States 100.
Okay.
And it follows, four of the top female runners. So it, Magda Boulay and, Devin Yanko. She runs for Wazelle.
Okay.
Casey, I'm going to butcher her last name, but I think it's Lichtig, and then Anna Mae Flynn. So it basically follows them as they run 100 states or Western States 100. And yeah, it's just really inspiring. Super, super cool. And it's on YouTube. So if you just go to YouTube and type in Life in a Day, Western States, it should pop up.
Okay. So, very cool.
Yeah, that's super cool. Yeah, and let's see. I won at one of the snowshoe races. I won this incredible beer that was so good.
What is it?
I need to get my hands. So it was a local brew by one of our local breweries, but it was an imperial stout that's aged in red wine barrels.
Ooh.
Super good. Yeah, super good.
Oh, man. What's the alcohol percentage on that?
It was high. It was like 11.
Oh, whoa.
Yeah, it was pretty high, but it was so, so good.
Yeah, I'm such a snood about beer, like, and it has, like, if it's not at least, like, 6 or 7%, I don't even want it because...
What's the point?
Thank you. I'm like, if I can get, like... you know, feeling relaxed off of one beer because it's 7%. That's perfect. Yeah. You know? Yeah. Oh, that's hilarious.
Another good one is, Allagash Black, which is another local. But it's another stout. It's like a Belgian style stout, but it's like 7% as well. Mm-hmm. So I'll have one of those tonight with dinner probably.
That's so good. Yeah. I had, I don't know, tax man something last night. I rely on my husband to buy it, and he knows that I won't even drink it if it's below 6%.
Yeah. Yeah, Mark likes to brew his own beer.
Oh,
it's been a while since all our brew stuff is in storage right now, but he made one that was, I think it was 9%, but it was really good.
What is the best, most recent book you've read?
Let's see. I'm reading two right now. I'm reading Rising Strong by Brené Brown, which is really good. You know, anything by her is pretty good. And then Tools of Titans. That's the Timothy Ferris book. And that one's kind of like it's almost like a reference book. Like you can pick it up and put it down pretty easily. It's huge. It's like super thick and long, but it's short little snippets about, you know, different people. So you can kind of come and go, and you don't necessarily have to read them all in order. You can kind of pick and choose from the different sections and sort of read who you're interested in.
So I think that's the kind of book I'd want a hard copy of, not on my Kindle.
Yeah, definitely not. Yeah.
And I have to say the Brené Brown book, I bought it on my Kindle like a couple years ago, and I think I got to 50% and I gave up. And
yeah, so Rising Strong, I'm having a harder time getting through that than Daring Greatly.
Yeah.
I read Daring Greatly in a flight. I think from cover to cover in one flight, I just chewed right through that. But I sing strong. I just feel like it's taking her a really long time to get to the point.
Okay.
Or to
okay,
get so to the examples. I'm not sure if it's good to know that it's not just me.
Yeah.
But well, yeah, I like got halfway through and I put it down. I just read another chapter last night, but yeah, I'm going really slowly through this one. And I thought I was going to like, I have a couple more books sitting on my shelf that I'm looking forward to getting to.
And you want to get through this one so you can move on.
And I
want
to get through this one so I can read those other ones. Because I don't like to leave things unfinished. So
well,
I feel like I have to finish it.
Still in my Kindle. I'm not going to give up totally. I mean, I could seriously go back just to finish it because that's how, you know, in the same way I want to finish. But I think part of it is that she keeps referring back to the research. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I understand. I mean, it's important that what she's talking about is well researched. I don't want to read something that's a load of crap.
Bluff. Right. Yeah.
But it's the terminology is getting boring to me, I think. And mm-hmm. That being said, I fell into her, you know, I know everybody loves Brené Brown, but I fell into her with, I don't know if she's done multiple TED Talks, but one of her TED Talks. And it was at a time where whatever she was saying, I really needed to hear it. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, I really like her. But yeah, her that book, I don't know. You know, it's one of those things where there's so many good books out there and you're like, why am I wasting my time reading something if I'm not enjoying it?
I know. Yeah, sometimes you have to cut ties, but I have a hard time cutting ties. So. Yep.
Do you guys watch any shows?
Mark watches shows. I always am doing something else.
Uh-huh.
So
same.
Like I never pick my own shows. Like I do really like Fixer Upper,
uh-huh.
but, I don't ever watch that cause Mark always chooses what we watch. So
you can like write while you guys are watching. And
yeah.
See,
like try to do email or, you know, training plans or like catch up on stuff, whatever. So, but right now he and the kids are really, or the two older kids are really into Deadliest Catch.
Oh,
so,
cute. That's cute.
Yeah. So they like to watch, Jack calls it Krabby.
Oh,
he's like, I want to watch Krabby.
I love it.
So we watch Krabby. But yeah. And before that they were watching Gold Rush. They were really into that. And Jack loved it because of all the excavators and the dump trucks and all that stuff. So
that's so sweet.
It's fun.
Well, I'm going to wrap it up since we are hour and a half in, but this has been such a treat to talk to you, and I appreciate you opening up and, you know, talking about some vulnerable things.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me on, and, you know, I guess I'm a firm believer that, you know, the more light you can shed on something, mm-hmm. you know, the less power it has over you, and also the more it can help somebody else, so... happy to talk about my experiences.
Well, enjoy the weekend with your cute little family.
Yeah, you too.
Okay, thanks, Sarah.
All right, thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
All right, everybody. Thank you so much for listening today. Thank you, Sarah, for coming on the show. I had so much fun talking to you, and I appreciate how open and honest you were. Yes, next week, I'm talking with someone who went from a 4+ hour marathon with 242. What? That is crazy. I had so many questions to pick her brain. So that was a lot of fun. And a little secret. Well, if you follow me on Instagram, you already know this because I posted something about it today. I am in the beginning stages of planning my very first live show. So excited about that. Lots of planning underway. Lots of things to do with that. I wanted to let you guys know that it's happening. And I hope to see a lot of your faces there. More information to come on that. I will get the date out to you ASAP, but know that it will be late September. All right, guys, if you're looking for ways to support the show, you can support one of my sponsors for the show, Now Foods. Go to now-2-u.com. Use promo code another, all caps, to get 25% off your purchase there. They have lots of great products they offer, and I personally use them. And by purchasing products from them, you are directly supporting this podcast. And if you're looking for other ways to support the show, head over to my Patreon page, patreon.com/Lindsay Hine. I have monthly bonus episodes over there on my Patreon page for all supporters. All right, you guys, you have a wonderful, wonderful weekend. Enjoy your Friday. And as always, all right, guys, bye-bye.